Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
High-end groceries in a low-income neighborhood. On the broadcast today, Whole Foods comes to Detroit. The IRS just can't seem to get anything right, can it? And where do you see yourself in 5 years? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 5th of June. Good to have you with us. The whys and wherefores of my trip to Michigan coming up in, what, 4, maybe 5 minutes? But first, our old friend, the Internal Revenue Service. The government agency voted most likely to keep making things bad for itself. There's going to be another hearing on Capitol Hill tomorrow, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, to be specific, and a hearing titled Collected and Wasted, the IRS Spending Culture and Conference Abuses, about which, two things. Number one, why do they give hearings titles? And number two, they're not kidding with that spending culture line. A new Inspector General report shows that over the past 3 years, the IRS has spent almost $50 million on employee conferences, including, in at least one case, a video of IRS employees dancing as part of what appeared to be a team-building exercise. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith starts us off today.
It's called the Cupid Shuffle.
To the right, to the right. This is harder than doing an op review.
It gets worse.
Whoop, whoop, in the house.
That video cost about $1,600 to produce. Most team-building programs start at around $5,000.
My question is always, are we deluding ourselves that they're creating some sort of net effect that they're not?
That's consultant Donna Flagg, who actually designs team building programs for a lot of Wall Street firms. She says she herself has been a victim of bad team building.
When we got back, they were still crazy, really bad managers.
Flagg says team building can build morale and help companies retain their workers. Merle Karsh is the president of Windy City Fieldhouse, one of the largest team building companies in the country. He says paying for team building is cheaper than replacing an unhappy worker.
You can do an event for $50 to $100 a person. You do a 1,000-person event for almost the cost of one employee for a year.
In 2011, companies spent more than $150 billion on employee training. Maria Devine Ogino was in charge of employee training at a large company for 10 years. She says the benefits of team building were evident in the way employees interacted when they got back.
So they were able to approach challenges and questions a little bit more comfortably.
Consultant Donna Flagg says companies are starting to use team building concepts with things like wellness plans and massage days.
Whoop, whoop, in the house.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Oh, man. All right, here's today's lesson. In just because you lend somebody $10.5 billion and bail them out of an existential crisis, that doesn't mean they're going to do what you want. Federal regulators have asked Chrysler to recall almost 3 million vehicles, older Jeep Grand Cherokees and Jeep Liberties, to be precise. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says the fuel tanks in those cars are faulty and dangerous. But Chrysler, as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner tells us, says no, they're not.
These sorts of disputes normally get worked out behind closed doors. Not this time. Chrysler insists these older Jeeps aren't any more susceptible to fuel tank fires than any other vehicle on the road. And it contends the Jeeps met the safety standards of the time. Still, Larry Veliquet at Automotive News says Chrysler's decision is a high-stakes gamble.
I don't think there's a PR professional that would counsel them to take this path if they didn't believe that they were absolutely right and that they were going to ultimately come out of this better than they went in.
The recall could cost Chrysler roughly $300 million, but it's harder to pin down the cost of defying federal regulators. The negative publicity has already started. Clarence Ditlow at the Center for Auto Safety says he was stunned at Chrysler's stance.
Because we've never seen a fire defect where children in child seats in the back of these Jeeps are literally trapped and burned to death.
Chrysler disputes the number of deaths linked to these Jeeps as well. Industry consultant Alan Baum says the automaker may want to consider Audi's experience in the 80s. Audi initially resisted a recall for unintentional acceleration.
When all was said and done, there wasn't sudden acceleration, but the damage to the brand was dramatic. So, you know, you can win the battle and lose the war.
Chrysler has until June 18th to change its mind. If not, regulators can sue the automaker in court. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
My money is on the Wawa trombones. When we get there, details, numbers, you know the drill. So, Michigan, Detroit in particular, the Midtown neighborhood to be even more specific, the site as of today of a brand spanking new Whole Foods store. Not the grocery retail outlet you might have in mind in a part of town where the unemployment rate tops 21% and half of the population lives in poverty. There are, though, upper middle class commuters who work here, the more typical target customer for a not cheap store like Whole Foods. We're going to talk to CEO Walter Robb about the business model he's got in mind for this particular store in just a second. But we went out the other day and asked around. We asked the locals how they feel about Whole Foods coming to town.
I think it's outstanding, and it's about time we got a grocery store here.
It's not for us. And, you know, everybody around here gets food stamps.
Well, as long as the quality is good, I'm willing to pay a little bit more.
All business is good business, as long as it's bringing more money to the city.
We live in a desert land, a food desert.
I heard it was going to be kind of expensive.
The scene earlier today at the grand opening, though, not controversial at all. There was a line down the block to get in the store. A couple of hundred people easy with brand new, bright blue, reusable Whole Foods shopping bags they'd been handed out. And a whole lot of curiosity as well. We caught up with Whole Foods CEO Walter Robb between the produce and the grain section. Walter Robb, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai. Appreciate being here.
This is nuts, man. Are all store openings like this?
This is a good one. This is a special one for Whole Foods. I mean, they're all wonderful, but this has a particular magic to it.
Why are you guys here? What was the point in coming to Detroit?
To make a contribution to fresh, healthy foods in this community. There's a story in Detroit that doesn't get reported, and that is all the wonderful things happening on the ground, and we're just happy to be a part of it.
Those stories get out sometimes, but the point is that this is a place that does not have the reputation as perhaps being a place where people would shop in Detroit, you know?
Yes. Well, you know, we believe otherwise. Yes, a bit of a risk, but we've built some wonderful community partnerships over the last 3.5-4 years, and we're very happy to be here.
Who's your target audience? Who are you trying to sell to in this store?
You know, we built this store to serve all of Detroit and all of Detroiters.
There are critics, though, who will say, you know what, they're just here for the folks at Wayne State who go back and forth to the suburbs, or the medical center who go back and forth to the suburbs. And, yeah. And really, the folks who live across the street in the projects aren't necessarily the ones you guys want to serve.
And believe me, I've heard all the criticisms. Yeah, I've heard everything thrown against the wall, and I don't care. We're just going to dive into it anyways. And the fact is that we've made a real effort to build a connection with all of the community here. And I think today shows you that they're here and they're with us, and we're doing it together.
On opening day, I mean, let's be fair.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. Journalists, skeptics.
Got it. Well, come on, right? I mean, you look
entrepreneurs,
at...
Entrepreneurs, believers.
I completely appreciate the point. Let me ask you this. If this store starts to lose money, how long are you going to be here?
That's a rock-solid commitment. We signed a long-term lease. We're here to stay.
How long's the lease that you signed?
25 years.
Let me ask you, actually, about the pricing. Larry, the store manager in the ceremony out front, called out the vice president of supply chain...
Bobby Turner.
For working with him to establish pricing for this store. Are you gearing prices here toward the clientele?
Well, let me just say we do the pricing in every single market that we serve. We're competitive, right? So every market we do that. But in particular, this market has some special pricing because this is a different market than the others that we've served.
You going to adjust back up as people get more accustomed to shopping here?
No. I made a personal commitment on behalf of the company for us to be affordable and accessible here.
Here comes a potentially tricky question then.
I love the tricky questions.
Did you have to teach people how to shop here?
Well, the store just opened, so we don't...
You know what I mean.
We've done classes on how to shop on a budget. Again, that's helpful for people. And also some basic ideas about health and wellness. And I think those things have been particularly well-received in this community. So even if people don't shop with us, if they shop somewhere else and it makes a difference in their health and wellness, that's a good thing.
You were quoted in the Wall Street Journal not too long ago saying you're going head-on against racism and elitism by opening up this store. What exactly does that mean?
What I said is, I said we came here to confront the issues of elitism and racism because people perceive Whole Foods as only serving a particular community or communities, and I don't like that. We have been, for the 32 years of our company's history, we've been a company that's bringing natural, organic, healthy foods to the world. That's the mission of this company. Still is the mission of this company. And I believe we should continue to serve more communities with that mission. So that's why we're here.
Walter Robb, CEO of Whole Foods. Walter, thanks a bunch.
Thanks a lot for having us on, Kai. We appreciate you being here today, in person.
That's right.
All right.
There are reports today that one of the biggest athletic doping investigations ever could be coming to a head. Major League Baseball is said to be on the verge of suspending several players linked to a Florida clinic that allegedly supplied them with performance-enhancing drugs. These aren't your average players, and these wouldn't be your typical suspensions. They could last 100 games, about two-thirds as long as the regular season. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports now on what that might mean for the business of America's pastime.
So let's take a look at the Milwaukee Brewers, whose star player Ryan Braun could be among those suspended. They want him real bad. How bad?
The Brewers are committed to paying him $145 million through 2020.
That's Pat Risch, an economist at Webster University. Braun has denied he doped, but what would happen if, bam,
strike three,
he's out?
The short-term financial impact is going to be largely limited.
David Carter runs the USC Sports Institute. Revenue from TV rights, corporate sponsorships, and season ticket sales is already locked in, he says. But if this drags into next season due to the appeals process, the outlook would be different. Howie Magner is editor of Milwaukee Magazine.
You're lessening your chances to win games, and not nearly as many people are going to show up to the ballpark.
Without Braun, the Brewers would lose star appeal and revenue, leading to possible payroll cuts and a downward spiral, Magner says. So far this year, the Brewers have struggled, but fans are still turning up to see Braun. David Carter at USC says baseball fans are loyal to the sport, if not the player.
I don't know that fans are really shocked anymore. They really just want to attend the ball game.
And a suspension would save the Brewers the portion of Braun's multi-million dollar salary while he sits out. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Susan G. Komen for The Cure, the breast cancer awareness group that made pink into a charitable identifier, has announced it's drastically cutting back on some of its fundraising. The group is going to cancel seven of the fundraising walks it originally had planned for next year. Sally Herships explains now what's in it for groups when people walk for a good cause and what happens when those walkers stay on the sidelines.
Imagine you're a charity trying to raise money. You could just ask people.
If I'm doing direct mail as a way of fundraising, I reach out to you. But when I engage you in fundraising through a walk or a run or a ride or a swim or a climb.
David Hesekiel is president of the Run, Walk, Ride Fundraising Council.
I'm getting you to ask all of your friends and neighbors to fundraise. That multiplication effect can raise a lot of money.
Hesekiel says last year, the 30 largest run, walk, ride events brought in just under $1.7 billion. But the charities don't get to keep all that money. There are permits, water stations, porta potties.
And of course, everybody wants a t-shirt.
These are very expensive events.
Robert Evans is the founder of EHL, a consulting group that helps nonprofits fundraise.
There are special event producers, there are special consultants, there are trade show and technology vendors.
Evans says walkathon costs can eat up to 50 cents of every dollar a charity raises, a lot more than what's considered a fundraising best practice. And heaven forbid it rains.
When one of these events get canceled, it's almost irreparable harm.
A thunderstorm can mean thousands of disappointed participants. But David Hesekiel says your friends will still give. They know you are willing to sweat for charity. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, it's performance review time. People, where will you be in 5 years?
In 5 years, I will be doing more with less.
But first, let's do the numbers. There they are, the wah-wah trombones. I knew they were coming. Adjectives tossed around about the markets today, volatile, skittish, or maybe just bummed out. The Dow Industrials dropped 216 points, 1.5%, closed at 14,960, the blue chips did. Let me say that again, 14,960. The NASDAQ off 43 points, 1.25%, landed at 3,401. The S&P 500 down 22 points, 1.3%, ended things at 1,608. Pain was felt pretty much across the board. Alcoa off 2%, Bank of America subtracted about 2%, J.P. Morgan Chase crossed off just less than 2%. Apple dropped nearly 1% after that patent ruling from Samsung you might have heard about the other day. Bond prices, while they rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.09%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses the state of the American dream, economic policy, and the future of the middle class. Shopping much? Many chain stores are scheduled to release retail sales figures for May. And it's the anniversary of the first federal gasoline tax enacted on June 6, 1932. 1 penny per gallon. That was just the beginning. Today it's up to 18.4 cents. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, today out of the studios of Michigan Radio. We've come to this corner of the American economy today, Detroit, to be specific, because after years, all right, decades, to be honest, of decline, there is a sense that things are just maybe starting to change. Witness the new Whole Foods we went to this morning. The neighborhood that store is in, Midtown, it's called, is a little pocket of recovery. But as Sarah Hewlett from Michigan Radio reports, economic revival doesn't come cheap and it doesn't come easy.
Sue Mosey is the unofficial mayor of Midtown. She knows every square inch of this neighborhood.
Okay, so first I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's going on right in this little area here.
Mosey runs Midtown Detroit, Inc., and for the last quarter century, she's worked to lure businesses, improve public spaces, and nudge along real estate deals. And all that effort is paying off. You can hardly take a step in this neighborhood without seeing some new coffee shop or boutique or, well, let's let Mosey pick it up. She's driving by what will soon be a live music venue.
It was formerly a porno theater. Well, not originally, but so anyway, they'll have restaurants on the ground floor, and then they'll have this whole live theater. And then this is 61 units of market rate housing.
It's a dizzying tour, a bike factory, a bookstore, pour over coffee, and this place.
I'm Joe Posch, and we're at Hue, which is a store inspired by classic bachelor pad style in Midtown Detroit.
Think cocktail shakers, cufflinks, fancy shaving gear. Posch opened his shop a few months ago, and he says he picked this spot because there's so much interest in and buzz around Midtown.
This is just, for me, retail ground zero in Detroit.
But Detroit's greater downtown, which includes this area, still lags behind other cities people point to as examples of urban rebirth. Per capita income here is just over $20,000. That's well below the average for cities like Minneapolis that have seen a revival of their urban cores.
A lot of cities have already undergone this change.
That's Kurt Metzger. He is a demographer with Data Driven Detroit. He says downtown Detroit is just starting to attract new white residents. To a demographer, that often signals higher incomes and education. But Metzger knows that for some folks, a sudden influx of new white residents can also mean the G word.
You know, there's this fear of gentrification. We're a long way from there.
Metzger says one thing that stalled growth in greater downtown Detroit is housing. There just isn't enough of it. Residential occupancy in Midtown is around 96%, and banks are still pretty tight-fisted when it comes to lending. And even if, or when, this part of Detroit catches up with places like downtown Pittsburgh or Minneapolis, Metzger says some perspective is in order.
Let's realize that, yeah, this is great, but this is 7.2 square miles in a city that's 139 square miles.
And ultimately, what happens in those other 131.8 square miles will matter to the long-term viability of this up-and-coming corner of Detroit. I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
Maybe you don't follow the comings and goings of Ben Bernanke as closely as we do, but if you catch wind someday that the Fed chairman is off to Switzerland, it's a pretty safe bet he's headed for a nondescript office tower in Basel and a meeting of the Bank for International Settlements. Even though the men in that meeting, and they are almost always men, basically control the plumbing of the global economy, you're not going to see any of them holding press conferences or background briefings. Adam Labore has a new book out about the BIS. It's called The Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. Adam, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Tell me about this bank. You set it up mysteriously, I will say, in the first couple of pages with a fancy conference room and 18 people meeting once every couple of months.
Yes, the Bank for International Settlements is essentially the most important bank that you've never heard of. It was founded in 1930 on a very sort of slightly obscure technical reason to handle German reparations payments for the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
But the real reason it was founded was so that central bankers, that's the governors of national banks like the Federal Reserve in America and the Bank of England, the Bank of France, could have somewhere to meet far away from the prying eyes of journalists and politicians.
What does it do then?
Well, the BIS is the bank for central banks. So as a bank, it offers banking services, especially if you're a central banker from a smaller country, mm-hmm. I don't know, Hungary or Algeria or somewhere, you need some expertise, you need some help, you need some rapid loan facilities. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about it is that it's a commercial bank, but it's legally,
as in money making?
Yes, it makes huge amounts of money, incredible amounts. It last year made tax-free profits. All its profits are tax-free of $1.17 billion.
It does seem to be playing right into the hands of those who would believe that black helicopters from the UN are going to come and take over the world.
I know, and that's something I was aware of when I was writing the book, you know. But these are the facts. The Swiss authorities have no jurisdiction over its property. They need its permission to enter. It has the protections, essentially, of the United Nations or a diplomatic embassy.
Given all that, though, and all the support, I guess, that it provides for the global international financial infrastructure, do we really want all these central bankers meeting in such secrecy that they don't even let journalists in the building?
Well, I think they're allowed to meet. They have a point when they say that we can't speak on the record about everything, because especially if you're a central bank and you're going to intervene in the market and you say, we think the dollar's weak, we're going to do this, and that information comes out, that's extremely valuable for people buying and selling, shorting the currency. But the current setup is basically a hangover from the 1930s of a different age of deference to authority, of secrecy, of technocrats saying, we know what's best for you, little people, and we're just going to get on with it. You know, the world doesn't work like that anymore. Well, I mean, it does in this sense.
It does, right? But maybe
but it's got to change.
Adam Labore's book about the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, is called Tower of Basel. Adam, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
We here at Marketplace are going to get a visit from HR next week. It's performance review time, you know. Expectations met, or we all hope exceeded, checks in boxes, and then the chance to play fortune teller, what we see for our future at the company. Commentator James Drummond knows the drill and says he's tired of one question in particular. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Since no one can see the future, I will answer by presenting 10 possible scenarios, which, admittedly, vary in their likelihood. Nevertheless, I feel it is best to try to be thorough so that at least one of the scenarios may prove true in 5 years. Please note that during previous performance reviews, I have been repeatedly told that I need to think outside the box. Scenario 1. In 5 years, I will have received a promotion. Scenario 2. In 5 years, the company will have realized what a hardworking, intelligent, and loyal employee I have been and will reward me for my long and dedicated service with a generous raise and a bonus. My performance rating will go from the unwarranted needs improvement to exceeds expectations. Scenario 3. In 5 years, I will have risen to the position of vice president. Scenario 4. In 5 years, I will own the entire company. Scenario 5. In 5 years, I will have given up trying to understand the phrase, think outside the box. Scenario 6. In 5 years, I will be living outside in a box. Scenario 7. In 5 years, I start working on a time machine in my garage at night. Scenario 8. Using my time machine, I have gone back and prevented the meeting of the man and woman who, without my intervention, would have eventually given birth to the HR person who came up with the question, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Scenario 9, in 5 years, I will be doing more with less. Scenario 10, in 5 years, I will be filling out this form again.
James Drummond is a contributor to McSweeney's and a writer living in Surrey, British Columbia. To see his whole essay and more like it, visit our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with the observance that Father's Day is just around the corner. Apparently, Oscar Mayer noticed that everybody from the internet to artisanal chocolate makers have been a little obsessed with bacon of late. So forget the wiener. They're marketing a butcher basic in a new ad for Father's Day that takes the style and the tone of a diamond engagement ring commercial. We get bacon in jewelry boxes, bacon held to the light like a precious gem. And yes, you can actually order it in a fancy box that comes with a money clip on their website. $22, although currently sold out, can also be purchased with bacon-shaped cufflinks. Those are $28. So, you know, if my family's listening, there you go. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 216 points. That's about 1.4%. The NASDAQ off 43 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 down 19 points, also 1.3%. Thanks today to the staff here at Michigan Radio. Carlos Asensio, Robbie Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back in L.A. tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.